If I needed to get 25, 50, 70% adoption of the doctors in the country, I had to get the doctor in Kansas City. I had to get the doctor in St. Louis, Chicago, Milwaukee to use our product and like it. And if I could do that, then we could build a really successful company.
While many in Silicon Valley disdain physicians, Michelle Snyder has made a career and an art form by figuring out how to appeal to them and encourage them to embrace emerging technologies.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. Hello, I'm Lisa Soonan.
And I'm David Chewitz. This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. And Lisa, I'm starting to feel like we're almost professional at doing this. As when I was leaving the house this morning, my youngest daughter, five, asked where I was going, if I was going to work. And I said, no, I'm going to, you know, record a podcast. And she goes, oh, have a happy podcast, Daddy.
That's awesome. Like a total sign of the times, right? In contrast, my daughter, much older than your daughter, when I told her I was going to go do my podcast this morning, I can't see her, but I'm pretty sure she rolled her eyes. And then she said something to the effect of, oh, Lord, help us. But anyways, be that as it may, we're excited to be here. And we're especially excited to have with us as our guest today, Michelle Snyder, who is Chief Marketing Officer of WellTalk and who's had a really successful career, amazingly successful career in the healthcare IT world. Michelle, it is great to see you.
Good to see you too, Lisa. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here today.
You are now obviously based in Silicon Valley, but had your start in the Midwest. Can you tell us a little bit about growing up? And I understand that your dad was a fireman.
He was, yeah. He was a fireman, and my mother was a public school teacher. I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and it was great. I mean, I have a fondness for people from the Midwest. I love going back there. And
you must have been crushed by that whole Green Bay situation last week.
I'm still processing. I mean, first of all, you guys have to understand there's nothing to do in Wisconsin for like 5 months, right? Except watch the Packers and cheer for the Packers when it's zero degrees out and eat cheese, right? And so I was crushed watching the game, but I was more crushed for all the people back home that, I mean, live and die for the Packers.
Well, at least the quarterback of the Seahawks is also from Wisconsin.
He is. That's true. I have to say I still would have rather watched the Packers win, but.
So did you go to University of Wisconsin?
I didn't know. I went to a liberal arts school, Carleton College, which was still in the Midwest in Minnesota. And then I actually went to graduate school at Kellogg. I got my MBA at Northwestern. So
was that a surprise to your sort of Midwestern conservative parents?
Yes, it actually was. In fact, funny story, when my father first came up freshman year to visit and he asked me where the bathroom was, and then I sent him to the bathroom and he came running back because he said that there were men in the bathroom. And I said, oh, it's a co-ed bathroom, Dad. And I think he was about to stop my tuition checks when he realized I went to college where they had co-ed bathrooms. But eventually he got over it. And I think he was proud for me to go there.
So my understanding is that after college, your first stint was in healthcare policy. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, going to a more liberal school, right? You talk a lot about how you want to change the world and be part of the process of changing the world.
We still believe that.
That's what the TV show Silicon Valley. Every company CEO says
that. That's true. Right? You're right. Right.
And change the world.
Well, it was actually interesting. So, my roommate in college, her family was in DC, and so I got my first job in DC in health policy. And I didn't have a place to live originally, and so they said I could live with them for the first month. And being kind of naive from the Midwest, I didn't really realize her father was head of the Congressional Budget Office. So I ended up living with them. And so, I'm used to being at home during family conversations and dinners talking about the Packers or what the neighbor did or when the potluck is or if we're having mushroom casserole. And then I go to having dinners where we're talking about what the president said, right, and what the Secretary of State said. So it was actually really interesting. But no, I loved it. I mean, D.C., you know, is obviously very different. I, quickly became immersed in everything health policy. One of the projects actually that I first worked on was being part of the secret Hillary Clinton task force during healthcare reform.
Wow.
And I mean, mostly I was in the back crunching numbers, but it was just kind of an interesting process to see how you try to make change within the government. And so I did that for a couple years. And then I think maybe I was a little too idealistic about how quickly things actually change within the government. And so I think I started to get a little antsy and a little bit frustrated that I felt like I wasn't making enough of a difference. So I went to another profession where I probably really wasn't making that much of a difference either, consulting. It was very fun though. I did healthcare consulting. It still had a health policy bent, but I also did consulting for biotech companies and venture capital firms. And that was fun because you might be on three or four different projects at a time. So you're learning about the different facets of the industry. But then at the end of the day, it was frustrating too, because you really, you know, you give your recommendations, but a lot of times you don't know if anything happened and you really have no ownership over seeing any of the changes through.
Well, I imagine that experience was pretty helpful in thinking about what you wanted to do next.
It definitely was. It was. And I think, you know, I went from one extreme to the other, right? From working in consulting to diving into an early stage startup where there were 10 people and we were in a garage working on doors and my pencil kept falling through because there was a hole where the doorknob was supposed to go because we didn't have enough money to buy desks.
So how did you get from DC to California? How did that happen?
Sure. So DC, then I went to graduate school at Kellogg, as I had mentioned, and Kellogg has a fantastic healthcare program, and it's also one of the top marketing schools in the world. And so I really loved marketing. My undergrad degree was in psychology, and actually I took a lot of economics classes. So I was really interested in kind of the whole notion of behavioral economics and
before they called it that,
and why people do the things that the way they do, and how you can influence them in a good way, right? Not the evil marketing influence way. And so after business school, I actually did consulting for a little bit. I moved out to California, and then I just really saw all of my friends going to startups, right? So this is in 98 99. The tech boom is going on, the bubble is large. And I just felt like I was missing out, right? And I could always go back and do consulting, but that if I didn't take this opportunity now to go to a startup, I'd always regret it.
And what did you not know, coming from consulting and policy?
Yeah.
What surprised you about joining a startup?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think the one thing that actually surprised me is that if you're going to an early stage company, what you get hired in to do and what your title maybe 1/4 of what you actually end up doing at the company, right? Because it's just all hands on deck. I mean, there were days I was plunging the toilet, right? Because the, you know, bathroom broke, right? And there's other days I'm talking to the CEOs of health plans. And so you never know.
Did you ever have to do those things at the same time?
Actually, that would be funny. You're right. I probably put the phone on mute when the toilet was flushing, and then I got back to the CEO.
So for those who don't know, the company that you're describing, that you're talking about, is Epocrates, which was really one of the very, very, very early players in, I don't even know if you'd call it HIT, medical trainee and then as an early physician, young physician, I used it all the time, and it was an absolutely transformative application. I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about, even from your beginning experience, how you wound up, you know, your interview with the company, how
Sure.
you sort of went from considering it to working there to what the experience there was like and what some of the strategy was.
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, it's funny to think about it now, right? I think the last survey I saw said 90% of doctors have a smartphone, but this was back in 1999, right? So there was no iPhone. There was no BlackBerry. There was no Galaxy. There was the Palm Pilot.
Yeah,
and
I
probably
remember that.
I think it was the 3X that had the plastic case that opened up, and the stylus, which I still miss my stylus. I love the stylus. And so, you know, it was just this idea. Well, actually, let me step back. The interesting thing about Epocrates is that that was actually not the first idea of Epocrates. So Epocrates was an idea out of Stanford Business School class project. And the original idea was to use the Palm Pilot at baseball stadiums to record stats.
To do the scoring.
To do the scoring. And so, I don't know if you knew that,
I did not know that.
So they did a lot of market research, and they tested it out.
Nobody, as baseball fans, I feel a little devastated that we didn't know that, David.
Nobody wanted to do this. And so one of the co-founders.
Yeah, because the fun of scoring is do it with a pencil
exactly,
in the old-fashioned way.
And the eraser.
And
you
kids.
Can doodle on the side, right,
yeah, exactly.
when nothing's happening during those 4 hours.
Hey.
I like soccer better. Okay. So, so they went back to class, and one of the people involved in the project, the co-founders, was Richard Fiodotin, who was a physician. So he started thinking about, well, maybe the Palm Pilot would be good in medicine because physicians are mobile. They're moving around. They're not at a desk. They're not really using a computer. And they're going back and forth between the office and the hospital. And so that would be a tool where they could always have the information they needed with them. So they put together, they started thinking about, well, what could a physician use? And so one of the things would be a drug reference guide, right? And so there was something called the PDR. There still is something called the PDR, the physician's drug reference, but it's a really huge book. And in many physicians' offices, it's a doorstop, right? Or it's
true.
A paperweight or something like that. And there's a lot of good information in there, but it's really hard to access. And so the idea was to actually kind of take the PDR and put it on the Palm Pilot and then also add drug formulary information. So what that is information that tells somebody if their health plan covers this drug or not, because that's a big problem. I don't know if you guys take, you know, prescriptions, but a lot of time either myself or I'm with my family and we go to the pharmacy and then you find out the drug's not covered, right? And you wait a couple days, right?
Oh yeah, no, it's a massive factor.
Yeah. So that was the idea, is to kind of put the PDR on the Palm Pilot.
That's so interesting because I remember this time. I remember then I was an investor and I had looked at this company, which I foolishly did not invest in, and three other companies, I think it was at the same time, that were at the very same time using a Palm Pilot, but to do e-prescribing.
Yes.
And I remember thinking at the time, nobody's ever going to use any of these things, or at least not soon. You know,
right.
Not my investment horizon.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you say that because I actually had job offers from two of the other companies that did e-prescribing. And the thing that kept coming back to me is that it wasn't something the doctor really wanted to do because it added time onto their day and it wasn't easy to do. So if you sat down and you saw a doctor using the Palm Pilot trying to do e-prescribing versus them whipping out the prescription pad and scribbling, illegibly, of course, but still, right? I mean, that took 5 seconds, right? Versus a minute or two to do the e-prescribing. And so I just had trouble seeing why a doctor would want to adopt that.
So it's interesting because I think, you know, we often talk, we, not me and you and the three of us, but people in Silicon Valley and related fields often talk about how important it is to have disruptive innovation, something profoundly different. This is clearly an incremental innovation. You know, this Hippocrates idea at the time.
It is. Yeah, it was not disruptive. It was thinking about how can we make the doctor's life easier and provide him or her value and make him or her look good in front of their patients.
So get into that a little bit, because I think one of the real successes, as I understand it, of Hippocrates was really gaining traction. And I feel like you're significantly responsible for the success of that. So maybe you could explain how you got into what some of the strategic considerations were and how you achieved that.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, it was interesting at first, and I think you and I were talking about this a little bit. There's kind of like the short view of the market, the short game and the long game, right? And so ultimately, you need to get as many doctors in your network as possible. And so our business model was actually the product was free for doctors to use and download, but we got paid by health plans and pharma companies, right? So we could make it free for the doctor, but in order for the health plans or pharma companies to be interested in your network, you had to get to 20-25% adoption, right? Because that's when they started to pay attention to you. So, I think the mistake that a lot of companies make, you know, if you're just thinking the short game, is that, okay, I have to get the most important doctors in the industry, the key opinion leaders, right? But those are also the people that everybody else wants to get. So pharma, and not as much anymore, but used to throw a ton of money at these guys, right? And they're busy and they're doing research and they're out speaking. And so you can get them interested in your product, but they have so many other things going on. You're not going to be high on their priority list. So our strategy was different. Our strategy was thinking about who are the influencers, but who are the influencers that will actually help us and like us and care and actually use their time to promote us. So thinking about that, you know, a couple of things that we did. We started this medical school and residency program where, so we had a free product, but we also had a premium product. But we went out to every medical school in the country and every residency program and said, we will give you the premium product for free. All 4 years in medical school and then in residency, right? Because the idea is that if you could hook them in third or fourth year
you could hook them on the entry
school,
level drug,
right?
You can get them on the...
It's kind of like what LexisNexis did in the legal field, right? But same thing with residents, right? So if you're a chief resident and we could get them to use us, they not only influence the people underneath them, but they also influence the doctors above them. And it was funny because we had several residents email us and say, I was on rounds and a question came up and nobody knew the answer. And I pulled out Hippocrates and I did a search and I knew it before the physician, right, that was attending.
So you were back to your Midwestern roots, looking for people in the middle of the country to talk to instead of the people at Sutter or Mayo. Or
you're
whoever.
Right. No. And in fact, I like to think this is true, but I really do think one of the reasons we were successful at Hippocrates is probably because I was from Wisconsin and I always had the view that I could get the doctor from Beth Israel to use our product. But if I needed to get 25, 50, 70% adoption of the doctors in the country, I had to get the doctor in Kansas City. I had to get the doctor in St. Louis, Chicago, Milwaukee to use our product and like it. And if I could do that, then we could build a really successful company.
So do you have a good anecdote about that experience, about a doctor, you know, either being excited or being not excited, thinking they're never going to use technology in the workplace like that?
The funny thing about Hippocrates is that's when I kind of knew it was going to be a hit. We would go to conferences in the Midwest or we'd get emails from doctors in the Midwest. And the funny thing is everybody, and sometimes they still do, but talked about doctors as being technophobic, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think the problem is doctors are technophobic. It's just the technology that had been given to doctors up to that time was not helpful to them, not useful, and it was pushed from the top down, right? When
so
we gave them this really simple to use, easy technology that they embraced and they felt like they had ownership in choosing to use that technology, it took off, right? And then it kind of went ground up.
I feel like you have a better understanding of sort of the sociology of medicine at a very granular level, more than most folks I know. How did you sort of apply that to thinking about how to get people to use it and some of the earliest adopters and how to approach that?
Sure. So I would say probably one of the things I'm most proud of is this program we call the Advocate Program. And so, you know, you kind of dream as a marketer to work at a company when you're getting 10, 15, 50 emails a week from people that love their product and are passionate about it, right? And I remember this one quote, we probably used it for 5 years on our marketing brochure that said, I left my stethoscope bets home and I went to work. I left Hippocrates at home and I drove 60 miles back to get it.
Wow.
Right? And so it just kind of went to how important our tool had become for the doctors. And so we get these emails and I said, we have to do something with these doctors. Like they want to tell people about this product and they're telling us they're telling other people. So we created this program called the Advocate Program where we made these really cute hats that said Hippocrates Advocate and then water bottle. They probably cost me $3, Hippocrates Advocate water bottle. And so when we'd get emails, we'd say, thank you so much. You know, we're starting this new program, the Hippocrates Advocate Program. It's for, you know, special elite small group of doctors that are really
passionate.
Because
doctors hate to be special and
exactly,
elite.
Exactly, right? There you go.
The
psychology,
else,
right? And we'd love for you to be part of this program. And all you need to do is tell other doctors about it. Do talks for us. We'll make presentations for you. We'll even sign you up at your physician conference to do talks on our behalf. But we'd just love for you to share the word. So we're not paying the doctors, which is actually interesting. I find that, especially for something like that, if we paid them, it probably wouldn't have worked because right. Then they equate it with work.
Right.
If we're not paying them, they actually feel like we gave them a good product and then they want to reciprocate and help us back. So we got several doctors on board and then it grew and it grew. And within 3 or 4 years, we had 2,000 doctors in the country who were Hippocrates advocates that all they got was a water bottle and a hat, right? And most of these guys are making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And they're going out on our behalf talking about it. So that's the best marketing you can possibly have, right? Is hearing from another physician how great something is. And
I told two friends and so on and
exactly,
so on.
Exactly.
I love it.
Well, with it helped that the product was absolutely delivering value and that people really liked it.
Exactly.
Well, that's true. But as I recall, and I, you know, that company, which now everybody talks about as a phenomenal success, and many of the people who started it went on to great success.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
That company, like many great companies, had some near-death experiences along the way. It wasn't a guaranteed success from the start.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that's the thing people forget is even if you look at the most successful companies, people always think it's just a hockey stick, right? You know, I joined the company in 1999.
Looks more like a mountain range.
It does. It was up and down and up and down. So I joined in 1999, right? And then the crash came and we were having trouble raising money. And I mean, we did two reductions in forces, right? We laid off about 25% of our staff. The trick for us, right, is that we had to get to 20-25% of adoption before pharma companies and health plans really paid attention to us and would pay us good money to reach those clinicians with information. And so, yeah, there were many times where we weren't sure if we were going to, you know, be around. And it's hard to lay off people. I mean, these people, you're working with them 10, 12, 14 hours a day. You're working on the weekends with them. You're eating dinner at the office together all the time. And then to have to lay off people who weren't just your colleagues, but your friends is really hard.
How do you get through those times? How do you motivate yourself and say, and not go into the, oh my God, this is going to fail, but say, I have to redouble my efforts and try again phase when that happens?
That's a great question.
Yeah, that is a really good question. I mean, it's really hard. At least for me, I think it was a couple things. One, it was that I just really felt we had a product that was changing how doctors practice medicine. I mean, it was getting, that's the thing is, I was getting so much feedback from our customers about how valuable and important it was. So I knew there was something there. We just kind of had to get over this hump and make it happen.
So you were there for how many years?
I was there for 11 years.
Yeah, a long time.
A long time, right. And so we went through, you know, reductions in force. We went through filing for an IPO, pulling the filing, refiling for the IPO, going public. Then I had left at that point. Then the company ultimately got bought by Athena Health.
And you were also there for a critical transition in technology from Palm Pilots to a more traditional, what we call now, more traditional. Right. Yeah, more traditional smartphone. But can you describe a little bit what that was like?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that was really fascinating. So as I mentioned back in 1999, really, there was just the Palm Pilot. And so the funny thing about the Palm Pilot is doctors love the Palm Pilot, right? So even when the iPhone came out, I mean, we struggled for several years because as many of you out there know, if you're a mobile developer, it's hard to develop for all the different operating systems, right? Doctors love the Palm Pilot so much, we had to keep it for like several years, even when nobody else in the market was using Palm Pilots, but doctors still loved
to buy them on eBay just to have them.
Exactly, exactly. So we had been doing well, you know, it probably been 5-6 years, we got up to about 25% adoption of doctors in the country, which was fantastic by any means, right? But if you have your board of directors, you know, and every meeting, your doctor numbers are still at about 25%, they're starting to wonder what's going to happen with the business, right? What is the next growth opportunity? And so, you know, I actually don't know what we would have done if the iPhone hadn't come out, but fortuitously, the iPhone had been out. It hadn't been open to developers yet. And we were in the enviable position that there were several senior executives at Apple that had heard about our product and were closely involved with the medical field. And so our CE got a call from an executive at Apple, and they said they were very interested in having us develop for the platform. And could we send a couple of our developers down to their offices? But we couldn't tell anybody, right? And they would just come down there for several weeks, maybe 6 weeks, and that we would be on stage with them when Steve Jobs announced that they were opening up the SDK.
Wow.
And so I know this now, but at the time there were only 4 people in our company who knew, our CEO, our head of engineering, and then the 2 engineers that we actually sent to Apple. So nobody in the company knew. And in fact, one of the engineers, he couldn't even tell his boss. He was from England, and so he told his boss he had to go back to England for a family issue that he had to resolve, which was like a month long. So at this point, everybody's starting to wonder if these people were coming back to the company. The day before the SDK announcement, the CEO calls me into the office and he's like, Michelle, you're probably going to be mad I didn't tell you this earlier, but we're going to be on stage tomorrow with Steve Jobs demoing our application for the iPhone. And I said, we don't have an application for the iPhone. He goes, yes, we do. We've been developing it down at Apple headquarters for the last 6 weeks. So I mean, that was amazing, right? And so at the launch, of course, we got tons of publicity. And I think we actually probably even got more publicity than we would have because the other people on stage with us were Disney, AOL. Wow. I think EA was on stage too, right? And then this little company, Epocrates, that nobody had really ever heard of. So then everybody was trying to figure out who we were. And so, I mean, you guys know the rest. You know how the iPhone basically changed the smartphone market and doctors love the iPhone. And so really that was kind of, I would say, kind of the second incarnation of the company, right? Where our numbers just started to take off. So we went from 25% to, by the time I left in 2011, we were probably at 60 to 70% of doctors in the country using our product.
You moved on from there, I know.
I did.
Took some time off and I know you're a big traveler, but you, sounds to me like you kind of ended up back at your beginning in the behavioral economics, the psych area, right? Because now you're at WellTalk.
I am at WellTalk, yes. So
yeah, help us understand what WellTalk does.
Sure. So what might help you understand, let me talk a little bit what I did before. So I went to a venture firm as an executive in residence where I did two things. I kind of looked at a lot of companies, and then I also helped work with some of our portfolio companies. So I probably looked at 400 plus companies in the couple years I was there. There's so many interesting things in digital health right now. I mean, mobile apps and services and just technology you could not have imagined. And it was so fascinating looking at all these companies. But what I realized is they were great ideas, but they were probably products, not companies. And I didn't really see how you could invest as an investor and get a return off of those companies, right? And so I started developing this idea that what there really needed to be was a platform that could integrate all these different products and services and then provide a cohesive experience for the consumer. Because it's the same way with like Epocrates with doctors. You want it easy, simple to use. The consumer doesn't want to have to go to 5-10 places to do everything related to their health. And so WellTalk was actually one of our investments. And I just became very interested in the idea of kind of this B2B2C model where you're giving consumers a platform that helps them match the different activities and resources and things they want to do with incentives and rewards for them to be healthy. And then also helps the digital health ecosystem by plugging in those programs. And so I ended up going there. I'm now the chief marketing officer, and it's great.
And you guys are one of the first companies to integrate the Watson platform.
We are, yes. So
I think a lot of people are interested in that because all we've ever seen of it is the Jeopardy stuff, and nobody's ever seen much else of it yet.
Exactly.
Except for press releases.
That's true. We have done a lot of press
checking
releases.
What Lisa would call checking the innovation box.
Yeah. Well, so our partnership with Watson, I think one of the reasons we were really excited to work with them. So we're their first consumer health partner.
Wow.
With Watson. Yep. And we were actually... IBM had not done direct investments in companies for, I don't remember how long it was, 15 years, 20 years or so. And they started the Watson Fund last year, mm-hmm. and it's $100 million fund. And we were actually the first investment in the Watson Fund as well. But going back to why we were interested in developing a relationship with...
Did you have to play Jeopardy to win the investment? Did you have to beat the machine or no?
No. And I can't even beat the people when I'm doing it at
home. Submit the bid in the form of a question.
Exactly.
So one of the reasons I was really interested in it, or we were interested in working with IBM Watson is, you know, one of the tenets that we believe you need to have a successful platform is personalization, right? So when I looked at a lot of products in the market... They give you general advice about what you should do about your health and wellness. But for example, there was one product my company had made me use, and I put in that I run 7 days a week, which I probably lied. I run 5 or 6, but anyway, right? So I put in I ran that much. And then it comes back with the recommendation for me to join a running group, like to get motivated. And I thought, I just told you. I run this. Like, that's not my problem.
Not
I
so
don't
much.
Need
yeah.
a running group.
You should
to
start
get
running
motivated.
Twice a day.
But then when you look at a lot of products, they give you the same recommendation. So the thought behind WellTalk is you really need a personalized platform that gets smarter and learns what you like to do and what your interests are. And that's what we believe Watson can help us with, right? So you have to feed Watson the information. That's the tricky part. Watson on its own is not smart, right? You have to put a lot of information in. And then you have to continue asking questions, right? So our product is called Cafe Well Concierge, and it's basically the idea it's a personal health concierge for you. But it will ask you questions. And so the more it learns from you and understands from you, then it can give you different recommendations based on what you like, don't like, based on your benefits, based on your health status. So we're feeding in information from the payers. And so that's why we're really excited. It's all to me about personalization. And there are so many other industries which do personalization really well. And I don't feel like we've done that yet in healthcare in terms of recommending what people should do.
So going back to your days in college, when you're studying psychology, what's the one question, what's the most important question that people need to be asked to make them think and care more about their health?
Oh, that's really interesting. Well, I don't know what the one question is, but the thing I will say is most people don't want to think about their health.
That's what Lisa's always
saying. And so you have to ask them questions that are actually possibly not related to their health to understand what motivates them, what interests them, what their goals are. Because a lot of times their goal, someone's goal isn't necessarily going to be to lose 20 pounds. It may or may not be. But their real goal is they want to be alive to see their child get married, right? Or their real goal is something personal. And if you could figure out what that is, that's what motivates people, not that they should eat vegetables or that they should walk every day.
That's great. Well, thank you, Michelle. This has been so interesting. I really have enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you so much for stopping by today.
Great. I had a lot of fun. Thank you, guys.